Cause number 1322003CR, the State of Texas versus Gustavo Lopez Mireles.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justices of this honorable court, opposing counsel. The first matter that the state would take up on this is the preservation argument and waiver raised by the defendant. Under Dinkins v. State, 84 Southwest 3rd, 639, the applicant in a Chapter 64 motion has a statutory burden to meet all of the factors. As such, this is in the nature of a sufficiency challenge to the order and the findings that the applicant and the appellee in this specific case actually met their burden. The state can't waive a sufficiency challenge absent a stipulation, which was not entered in this case. We may have at certain times focused our argument.
But you can be noted to be that by not arguing against it, that you have not contesting the facts that they've set out, and as such, maybe not a waiver, but not are contesting those issues.
Correct. However, in our motion, we actually did contest each fact. At the hearing, we only contested certain issues because that's what the evidence was going to be raised on. But in our motion, we did contest identity. We contested the preponderance of the evidence standard for proving his innocence, and we did contest the testability and also the retesting standards. And some of those were contested more at the hearing.
But if you did not contest them at the time of the hearing, does that not mean that you are conceding the facts, almost like you're conceding the factual underlying, maybe not the argument of their basis of their motion, of their matter?
I would say not, Judge, because it's still a sufficiency. The trial court is required to find by a preponderance of the evidence that a certain factor has been met by competent evidence. The state has no burden in these cases, so we can't really be required to marshal any evidence or contest any facts. The applicant or appellee in this case had the full burden, just like we do in a criminal case. In this case, the applicant had the full burden.
I was going to ask that question about the burden because with regards to testability, I'm not sure whether it was by affidavit that was submitted to the court. The state said it was unknown whether the evidence was testable.
That's correct, Justice.
So that's not the same thing as not suitable for testing.
Correct. We did stipulate that, and it was a stipulation. Both parties signed off on that affidavit, that portion. Because they were stored in the district clerk's office under unknown conditions, we can actually determine whether or not they were testable or not.
So how would you ever get to the point where someone could, with absolute positive knowledge that you could test
So it mostly would be done by an expert testimony that in the cases where they have found that and it was a contested issue, the opposing sides had experts, and one side or the other's expert was believed. In this case, Judge, the only expert that testified even partially on testability would have been Dr. Vanessa Nelson from the Wesco Crime Lab, and she did say that there are certain conditions that they would have preferred for testability, that is climate controlled and maintained. As to the stuff in the district clerk's office, they would say that would have been difficult because they don't know what condition and what level of containment was on those items. There really wasn't any testimony directly related to that. And then the way it was stored, or if it was intermixed or touched by multiple people, it was admitted at trial. So multiple people did touch that evidence. So we're not sure. There would have to be a lot more samples.
So it was taken. A stipulation that
yes, Judge.
Neither party knew whether or not it was testable.
Yes, Judge, that's correct. Okay. And that would be where we would go on to, their burden was not met as to the evidence in this case, but not necessarily for the same reason. There are multiple factors here, and there may be reasons that each piece of evidence fails, at least in the state's position, depending on what category it falls into.
So are you telling us that certain materials, depending on what it is testable and whether not, and you have to then carry the burden to each individual piece of evidence? Is that what you're arguing to the court?
So as to the pieces that are within the DPS crime lab, both the extracts and the originals stored there, there was testimony that those would be in a testable condition. They were maintained in the proper environment. They are segregated. They are kept in a secure location. So as to, it's I believe, anything after J through T, is maintained by the DPS crime lab. The state will concede that's in a testable condition and is able to be tested in that manner. It's A through J that the state of Texas believes there was not actual evidence on testability that would meet the preponderance standard. We just aren't sure what condition it's in. as to the evidence that was stored by the Sheriff's Department, it was specifically said it was not in a climate-controlled environment in South Texas, but that's only from 2014 on, because the custodian that was called was only the custodian from 2014 on. We don't even know how it was stored, although he presumes it was in the same type of plastic bin from 2001 to 2014 when he took over that.
The testability, though, of the evidence held by the DPS crime lab, you're not contesting that that's
no, Judge. Okay. Those extracts would definitely be considered testable. Dr. Nelson specifically said they would be testable, and we're not contesting there was evidence that would support that finding. It's just as to the originals that are not held within DPS crime labs.
I'm interested in the argument that's being made by Appley that certain testing could result in an exclusion of Mr. Mireles. Can you address that, please?
So as to which items, Judge? The items that were never tested or the items that were tested and inculpated him originally?
There is that much in my notes. I apologize.
Okay, yes, Judge.
I maybe I could clear that up. I know that there was one blood stain on the vehicle that
yes,
was
Judge.
Tested that showed that there was a likelihood of 1 in 1,680,000,000,000 chance that it could be someone else other than him.
That's true for Caucasians, Judge. For almost all of the evidence, if it was for the Hispanic population, it was actually 1 in 147,300,000,000. So it was a lower chance just because that's the way the DNA works. They do when they did probability analysis that way, they did break it out by race or nationality to a point. So it is a very high standard, but that's based on the 9 loci they found. There was 2 blood stains on the vehicle that were tested, 1 blood stain off of her jeans that was tested, and the pubic hairs in the purse that were tested and inculpated the appellee in this case. The other evidence was either not tested or, in the case of the rape kit, to the extent that they could find anything, which was very limited, they only found 2 loci, it excluded the defendant because it was female DNA, which the victim was female. It was, again, to the extent that they could include anyone, the victim was included, although at a very low level. So in terms of what we would argue after that, the evidence in Mr. Morales' vehicle, they asked, which is items J, Q, R, and S. J and Q are the originals, their hairs and blood stains. R and S are the extracts that DPS took of those. The state would argue that they have not shown identity as issues. Under Pribble, the Court of Criminal Appeals said for identity to be an issue in a case, the sample that they're asking to be tested has to be able to show you who the perpetrator was. And in this case, the evidence in Mr. Morales' vehicle wouldn't actually necessarily be connected to the crime if it's not his DNA. Her DNA being found or not found in his vehicle might inculpate him, but it not being found there doesn't actually exculpate him in any way. There was no direct evidence, testimony or otherwise in this trial that she was ever in his vehicle at all. So her DNA not being found there really doesn't change anything. Some third party's DNA being in there doesn't tell us that third party was the person who killed the victim in this case. So because of the way identity is defined in Pribble by the Court of Criminal Appeals, we would argue that they can't meet that burden because that specific DNA does not have any ability to show us who the perpetrator was. And that's the requirement that the Court of Criminal Appeals set. Basically,
I thought that the argument of identity is that it had been a 2 days so that other people were involved and they were other suspects. And so trying to match that DNA to someone else who was also of interest would have exculpatory evidence that would fit the Chapter 64.
Possibly as to the vehicle where the body was found. As to Mr. Morales' vehicle, we would say that wouldn't. There's no evidence or necessarily anything that would show that a third party who had their DNA in Mr. Morales' vehicle would have any ability to tie that person to the crime in question. Because if Mr. Morales didn't do it, then his vehicle wouldn't necessarily have the perpetrator's DNA in it. So assuming exculpatory results for any DNA found in his vehicle, that still doesn't show identity would be at issue, because it has no ability to actually show who the perpetrator was as to that. And they do rely on that in their brief on Smith v. State, in which they say, in Smith, the Court of Criminal Appeals says, to raise the issue of identity, you merely have to maintain your innocence. That's because of the way they were looking at the pleadings. They did not say that merely maintaining your innocence proved by a preponderance of the evidence that identity was at issue. And 2 years later in Pribble, they clarified that identity being at issue is DNA specific. That's what Pribble says on 470 of that opinion. It's DNA specific. So the DNA they want analyzed needs to show that identity would be at issue by having some ability to show who the perpetrator was. Additionally, again, they wouldn't necessarily be exculpatory results for those pieces, because even if we presume it wasn't the defendant's DNA, that evidence wouldn't inculpate anyone. It wouldn't show who else committed this crime for the very reason that identity was not at issue. For the other evidence at the crime scene, the sexual assault kit has, again, already excluded the defendant. And the presumption, the only presumption that we have, is that exculpatory results would exclude the defendant or the applicant in the case. They don't show any specific results. So because the jury already heard that the evidence in I and O, the sexual assault kit, excluded the defendant, further refinement of that exclusion wouldn't do anything for us, because it doesn't necessarily prove a perpetrator, because in this case, the court directed out the sexual assault. They made the finding that there was no sexual assault. So this is only for a murder. There is no finding that sexual assault occurred, so no finding in a sexual assault kit would necessarily tell us who the perpetrator was. And in any event, he was excluded already. Because we only presume exculpatory results being excluding the defendant, the jury already heard that and didn't have a problem convicting in light of exculpatory results. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said that that's the way we would look at something that's already excluded the defendant.
Let me ask you a question. Yes, regarding the laboratory issue, you've argued there was no evidence that the DNA testing in this case was involved in that audit. However, as you know, Appley's arguing that the proximity of this audit in 2003 to the 2001 testing raises or calls into question the reliability of the testing. Was that an argument that would satisfy the evidence here?
The only individual who discussed that at all was Dr. Nelson, and she said they do annual audits. So they would have had an audit in 2001, 2002, and 2003. The only audit that came back problematic was in 2003. So there was two intervening potentially audits and at least one intervening audit in which there were no problems found between the evidence that was tested in this case and the failed audit, to the extent that they failed an audit.
But are these the kind of audits that are mentioned in Chapter 64 that was conducted by the Texas Forensic Science Commission, or are these just a separate type of audit that the DPS does?
These were internal audits by DPS. The Forensic Science Commission didn't exist at the time the audits were conducted in this case. It wasn't until after this that the Forensic Science Commission even was formed. So
how do we address that matter as it pertains to the statutory requirement under Chapter 64?
So the state's not contesting that a failed audit would do. We're not really, because the Forensic Science Commission didn't exist. We're just saying that because there's at least a two-year gap and intervening time, and the analyst, Dr. Nelson, specifically said this case was not implicated in any way in any failed audits, based on the notes, that it's not within the failed audit meaning of Chapter 64.
Did the McAllen facility ever reopen?
Yes, Judge. It reopened in McAllen because they did not move until 2008. It was only closed for about a three-month period from June till September-ish, maybe 3 or 4 months. And some of that was related to the failed audits. And Dr. Nelson said it was just, she wasn't sure, she wasn't here, but it was just the severity of it and them wanting to make sure that they were 100% good on the procedures.
In 2001, do you have a specific date range of when the items were tested?
I don't on me, Judge.
Were they tested in 2001?
I believe they were tested in 2001.
Okay.
They definitely were tested before 2003. I believe Dr. Nelson said they were tested in 2001 in her testimony. As to the items not tested, A, B, E, G, H, K, and N, this isn't not a case where definitively it was a lone assailant. There isn't any eyewitness testimony that says only one person did this attack. Based on some of the evidence and the way the victim was positioned in the vehicle, it could be argued that there was multiple individuals, which means exculpatory results, i.e. evidence just being in that vehicle of a third party, would do no more than muddy the waters. There might be a new co-defendant or another assailant, but they don't necessarily do anything to say that he didn't do that, even on the evidence in the vehicle, unless you 100% exclude the inculpatory results we've already found. Under Routier, the Court of Criminal Appeals did an item-by-item analysis when they're doing this. And if you do that item-by-item analysis, I don't believe that you would exclude the inculpatory results as appellee would have you do necessarily, merely because they've challenged those inculpatory results. I don't know that those go away.
Just before you run out of time and before you sit down, I want to kind of take a step back and understand the appellate review from us on this case as to the standard of review. It's my understanding that we do have to give deference to all the findings of facts made by the trial court in this case. Is that correct?
If they are supported by the record and they were historical facts that were determined based on credibility, this court is supposed to give deference, but they have to be supported by the record.
All right, and so there is a argument being made in this case that since the trial judge was also, this judge that ruled on this motion is also the trial judge, that his historical, as he has, was the presiding judge, should be given complete deference as to the facts of that case.
So I would argue, Judge, that because he wasn't the finder of fact in the original trial, his determination of credibility should be at least somewhat weakened because he doesn't know what the jury believed and didn't believe, which is, at the trial level, the only one who gets to determine credibility. He at most got to direct out, which he did. He directed us out on count one, the capital murder, because he found there was no sexual assault, and he directed us out as to one of our two theories on count two. He directed us out on that it was definitively a knife, because we didn't have evidence of that, and we only proceeded on the weapon being an unknown to the grand jury. But he does not get to determine credibility, which is a necessary finding here on what evidence Mr. Morales would be allowed to rely on to counter any claims. The jury weighed that credibility, not the
trial
court.
Let me finish my question because you're out of time. So then the question becomes, once we give that deference, if there is any evidence to support the trial judges as to the evidentiary sufficiency of the evidence, that is sufficient to support the affirming of this order. Is that correctly the correct standard?
If there is any evidence to support that identity would be at issue because of this specific piece of DNA because of that, or that by a preponderance of the evidence the defendant would not have been found guilty, yes, I would. Right. I would agree that if there's any evidence in the record to support it and it was based on a fact, that this court would have to do that. Our argument would just be that there isn't evidence in the record.
Yeah, you're claiming there's just no evidence to support it at all.
Certainly not on the identity. As to the preponderance of exculpatory evidence, it depends on the pieces of evidence. We would argue it's not on the items that weren't tested just because it just muddies the waters, because we don't have any evidence that directly links most of that evidence to a lone perpetrator type example, where by excluding the defendant, we would know that only someone else committed this crime. As to the evidence that did inculpate him, obviously if that went exculpatory, the state would have to concede that that was highly probative and mattered. We just argue on whether or not he would necessarily be excluded on why it would be probative. Dr. Nelson's only testimony was that she wouldn't expect him to be excluded absent a family relationship with the donor. At most, she would expect it to still remain Gustavo for a family member and a potential additional donor. And because it doesn't really exclude him, the state argues that retesting wouldn't show more accurate and probative results. We did concede accuracy because they would find more locations that would be more accurate. And they argue in their brief that merely being more accurate means it's more probative, but the legislature included both terms and we're supposed to give effect to both terms. So merely being more accurate cannot make it more probative. It may influence it being more probative, but it on its own can't make it more probative.
Okay. May it please the court. This case necessarily involves the application of complicated scientific principles to facts, but it has been made unnecessarily convoluted trying to follow this evidence through the crime lab, through trial, and now through the appellate order, as each piece of evidence has been given at least three designations, from a lab number to a state's exhibit number and now to an order number. And so I hope, and been trying to follow that evidence and see if it satisfies Chapter 64, has been strenuous, but I think we'll hopefully be able to see that it has met those standards and that the trial court, this court should affirm the trial court's decision. On your first slide, you'll see my roadmap. I do believe the state has waived all but two of its exhibits it raised, or two of its complaints it raised in its brief. It has properly preserved the complaint that evidence is not in a condition suitable for testing, and the complaint that Mr. Morales has not satisfied his preponderance standard under Chapter 64. I will notice that most of this evidence is actually governed by a concession that it is suitable for testing. I know we just heard that only items K through T are suitable, but that's because those items were at DPS, and there are more items than just K through T retained by the Department of Public Safety.
So if you stipulated to the wording in the affidavit or the document that was in the trial court, it says that, and I used the word earlier, what did I say?
Unknown.
Unknown. So you weren't known, and the burden's on you to show that it was suitable for testing. How do you reach that that burden?
So for those items, we'll look at the testimony of Vanessa Nelson, because those items, I think you're talking about the items retained by the sheriff's office and
yes,
the district clerk's
yeah.
office?
Yes, because I think that we're not talking about the ones held by DPS. They're okay. only the ones held in storage by the sheriff's office or the clerk's office.
So if you'll turn to slide 6, you can see the testimony of Ms. Nelson on this matter. She says, so what we're looking at is, was it the evidence stored securely? Was it stored in a climate-controlled environment? Because if it was stored in some place that's not air-conditioned in South Texas, the heat, the humidity is going to degrade the DNA over time. So that's what we would expect, that's what we would look for the bulk evidence. And then for the evidence that we've got kept here, the cuttings and the DNA extracts, we would look at conditions. So if there was a condition problem, originally we might decline to test it again. So as I read Ms. Nelson's testimony, I saw three conditions that made that unknown evidence testable. Whether it was stored securely, whether it was stored in a climate-controlled environment, and whether conditions originally...
But did she answer those questions, or did she say, we don't know whether, how they were stored?
So I don't think anyone's contesting the security of the sheriff's office or the district's clerk.
Not security, but the conditions, the temperature, and the humidity, and the weather, and all those other things. I mean, what I'm getting at is that you both said that you're unsure, and then I don't see how Ms. Nelson's testimony gets you to we are sure, because that's the standard, isn't it, that we know that it can be tested.
Well, I believe, as I read that, I look at the degradation argument brought by the heat and humidity of South Texas as an affirmative defense as to why this evidence is not suitable for testing. And the court heard evidence that the heat and humidity in South Texas may make it unsuitable, but rejected that notion and did find that because the evidence was suitable for original testing, and there is evidence in the record to support that it was suitable for testing originally, that it met Ms. Nelson's third test, that as long as there's not a condition originally, we wouldn't decline to test it again. I'm happy to walk through that evidence if that'd be helpful. But I do like to return for a moment to the other evidence the Department of Public Safety has retained. This is going to be on slide 4. So these are the samples I believe should have consensus. So on the left-hand column, you'll see the original evidence. The middle, the second column, you'll see the description. The third column, you'll see the extracts. And then the last column, you'll see the lab number. And the highlighted samples are the samples that the state has conceded are suitable for testing. Now, in this briefing, the state has made a distinction without a difference that extract evidence is suitable for testing, but original evidence is not. And the state doesn't even follow its own delineation in marshaling its evidence, because it concedes that item Q is suitable for testing, which is original evidence. It's not an extract, it is a hair collected. But when you look at why the state has conceded this, it's because, as Mr. Morris just said, all these items have been retained by the Department of Public Safety. And in the joint stipulation regarding the location of the evidence and its condition, in the clerk's record 427 through 430, you'll see that the Department of Public Safety has retained physical collections, samples, and cuttings of the original items, of the original evidence for these 7 items listed on slide 4. And so for that reason, any testing that would have to be done on those original evidence could be done on the samples retained by the Department of Public Safety, if even necessary. Because as a practical matter, the extracts will always be used before the original evidence, as the crime labs are very conscientious about retaining that original evidence so that we can do things like this oral argument here 20 years later and ask for retesting. I would like to draw the court's attention to slide 2 briefly. These are the 10 items that have consensus on whether they're suitable. And so no matter who the court rules for today, I would just ask that the trial court's findings on suitability on these 10 items not be disturbed.
So they're saying, though, that those items don't matter because they move away from the ability to test to the ability of either identity or exoneration, as I'm calling them, as I review them. Mm-hmm. So how do we get past, if we get past the admissibility of testing these, how do we get then past these on identity and exculpatory, as argued this morning?
So, as I read the case law, identity seems to be an issue where additional testing can't muddy the waters. And most of the cases the state cites rest on the defendant asking to identify a third individual in addition to their own on this evidence requested to be testing. But Mr. Morales is saying, and the argument is that he's not looking for a third donor, a third party. He's looking for an exclusion because a false inclusion was made at the time of trial. Chief Justice Contreras, I believe you asked about this on the state.
I thought in some of your slides it says why additional donors are probative, and I thought that's what you were looking for, additional donors.
That's correct, and as we heard testimony from Ms. Nelson, we can expect additional donors and alleles to be present on new testing.
Okay, so let's assume but not decide that I think it's four pieces of evidence that were collected and tested and showed that Mr. Morales, or the likelihood of someone else, was for Hispanics, we will assume that he's Hispanic, right? Was 147 billion, 300 million Hispanics. So, and that's using the 9 loci.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to retest it, you're going to use the 23 loci, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so how does that eliminate Mr. Morales? Or how could it eliminate Mr. Morales from those four or five pieces that had that result?
So if you'll turn to slide 12, I'd like to walk through a hypothetical because I do believe this is an issue that gives courts concern when there is inculpatory results on the table. So on slide 12, you'll see a screenshot. This is an excerpt from the Texas Department of Public Safety's case file. This is a portion of the DNA profile of item 5, a stain from the victim's truck. Now, I say it's only a portion of the profile because a DNA profile, even at the time, would have had multiple what we call channels. This is only the, as you can see here, the yellow channel or the yellow dye. And the new testing uses up to 5 channels. You have a red, blue, green, this is the yellow, and a purple dye. So looking at this portion, you'll see that there are 3 sets of alleles. Those are the 2 peaks across the x-axis. And they're designated by their height on the y-axis, which relates to how much DNA was detected in the sample. So I found the screenshot to be a little hard to read. So on the next slide, I did make a recreation of this evidence to the best of my ability. And so you'll see we have, in this yellow channel, this yellow dye, 3 loci that were tested originally for item 5. We have a D5S818, D13S317, and D7820. And I think for the purposes of this hypothetical, we can really just look at one locus and see how additional alleles or donors could be exculpatory and are probative. So if we look at slide 14, this is how the evidence was interpreted originally at trial. It was a single 11 allele. The analyst determined that the profile overall was single source. And so that this single allele must have been an 11-11 because each individual inherits a single allele from your mother and father. So this person must have inherited an 11 allele from their mother, an 11 allele from their father, making an 11-11. So any individual who's not an 11-11 will be excluded. Any person who is an 11-11 may be included. Mr. Morales is an 11-11 at D7S820. Now, why additional alleles are probative, if you'll switch to slide 15, and again, this is a hypothetical, but this is what additional alleles could prove. So let's say upon retesting, we detect a 10 and 12 at this locus. Well, now, already we know that the interpretation must change. It must be a mixture, because we have 3 alleles detected. And so since an individual can only have other 2 alleles, this must be at least a mixture of 2 people. And so what we determine, though, by adding only 2 alleles, we've increased the possible contributors to this mixture to up to 6.
So are you telling us that originally, under slide 14, the evidence put in front of this jury was that the stain on the victim's truck could only come from Mr. Cisneros by the long numbers that were given earlier today?
Correct. It came from a single person, and then you heard the statistics that is very unlikely as anybody else.
Right. And so if you retest it, then I'm just trying to move it along and make sure that I understand it as you're going through. You're now indicating that it can be argued that that blood actually came from more than one source.
I believe by Ms. Nelson's testimony, that is a possibility upon retesting, that it's no longer single source, it is a mixture. And that the only combination that once included Morales is now one of 6 again, in this hypothetical, one of 6 possible combinations of people who could have made this mixture.
But you didn't answer my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So now you have a possible, or it's possible that there's more than one contributor. How does that affect the statistic or the number for Mr. Morales, even if you find another one? Would it be 1 in 20 billion? or one in 100 billion? How does it change the fact that there was blood detected that they said it was his?
And I think that's the crux of this complicated argument, Justice Tirana, is that it's not that the stat needs to be lowered, it's that the stat is incorrect because it's a false inclusion. And that this 11 that was once attributed to Mr. Morales, again, going back to my hypothetical, should have been attributed to other combinations of genotypes that weren't detected because of the lack of sensitivity at the time. And if you look at slide 16, this is the hypothetical I lay out. So if you can imagine in this hypothetical a true donor of a 10-11 and 11-12, but only the 11 is detected because since those 11s are shared, the alleles get stacked and it's bright enough to get detected. So at the time, it looks like just an 11, but upon retesting with more sensitive equipment, you detect those other donors. That shows that it never was an 11-11 and that it should have been a 10-11 or 11-12 or whatever the evidence would support. And that inclusion that once convicted Mr. Morales was incorrect. And that may sound a little far-fetched.
Well, does that mean that any time in 2001 when DNA was tested using 9 loci, that none of it is any good?
It does not mean that. And I understand the concern that this would basically be a you know, kind of an open door for all retesting of evidence that only used 9 loci. But in this case in particular, I do think there's additional concern because of the reliance on what the research calls modal alleles. These are the alleles that occur most frequently in a population. And so as you can imagine, since they're the most common alleles in a population, they're also the most likely to be shared. So they're the most likely to get bumps at low-level contributors above that detection threshold. And so when you look at the state's, the interpretation used to convict Mr. Morales, it used the modal allele at 6 of 9 locations. And those, the percentages of the population that share that same allele as Mr. Morales are listed on slide 17. And the research showed that when you have such a high reliance on modal alleles, it requires additional loci to determine true from false inclusions. And that's why we believe going from the 9 loci to the 23, in this case in particular, is especially probative because it gives the analyst additional information to make a true inclusion or to support the inclusion that was made.
I have a question. I noted in your brief, and I think what this, all of this technical stuff that you're testifying to is laid out on roughly pages 30, 31, 32 in the brief, because I was trying to understand it. But I noted that you said on page 30 that Nelson omits from her testimony, that was page 32, you started missing from her answers, page 30, and then you've got these lengthy footnotes that set out all of this technical data that you've given us. Was that before the trial court? What was before the trial court that supports these arguments that you're making?
Before the trial court was the evidence of Ms. Nelson that additional testing could exclude Mr. Morales. And so that evidence is enough to support the trial.
That's enough to support, even though all this detailed technical explanation of all this was not?
It is, but my reading of case law, and I think of human nature, says that when justices and judges see inculpatory results, I do think a thumb gets put on the scale, intentionally or unintentionally. And so there is evidence before the court that retesting may exclude Mr. Morales. But you have inculpatory results that you have to do something with. And it seems counterintuitive to ignore them. But through all this technical research and explanation, I'm trying to explain that even though an inclusion was made, there isn't necessarily confidence in that inclusion, which is why we're asking for retesting.
And so I know we're getting close here, so I did want to touch on the of the argument, and that is that it was tested in a facility that was shut down because it was audited. Now, I think the state conceded that the Texas Forensic Science Commission was not created at that time, but there was an audit done, and that audit shut down temporarily the McAllen DPS labs. And in your brief, you ask us to follow the spirit of the law. But really, the question is, how attenuated from the testing to the audit that finds some fault, how far can we go? How far are you asking us to go? Because in context, 2 years can be a very short period of time, or 2 years can be a very long period of time. And I'm guessing you're wanting us to believe it was a short period of time, but how do we get to that this testing in 2001 had anything to do with the audit in 2003.
No. I don't have the dates in front of me, but I believe that audit identified some 300 cases that were impacted, if memory serves. And I can absolutely get that to you in a post-oral argument brief if necessary. But I think because of the seriousness of that audit finding, the amount of cases involved, the fact that it did have to shut down, that it involved the handling of evidence, that because of the seriousness of that, that may deprive applicants like Mr. Morales of post-commissioning testing, that it be not held against him, but it be read in his favor. And so how far back, I don't have an answer.
And how do we balance that, as you discussed earlier, a few moments ago, as you called it, opening the floodgates of then having to retest everything in every case that coming out of that lab starting in 2000, 1999? I mean, we're talking hundreds. How do we balance that as only in this case?
I guess you'd have to look at the other standards of Chapter 64, Justice Benavides, that the other standards would help put goalposts on that testing, that maybe identity was an issue in all those cases, that maybe they wouldn't meet their preponderance, that maybe, like in Swearingen, there's a mountain of evidence against these applicants outside of the DNA testing. And so the other filters, because Chapter 64 has numerous gates that movements must move through to get DNA testing ordered. And so by opening the floodgates to one doesn't necessarily open them to all, would be my answer to that. Let's see, just a few minutes left. I would like to spend my last minute here talking about the preponderance argument. So the state has, the calculus for this state standard is that you need to look at the state's case, assuming all the DNA is exculpatory. And then does the state's conviction, stand? Is there at least a 50% chance that conviction would be maintained, or is there a 51% chance that the conviction would not have occurred, in which case the defendant has met his burden? And I think in this case, when you look at the evidence the state had outside of DNA, in their opening, they said...
We gave counsel for a state a little extra time, so go ahead.
I appreciate that. In its opening, the state said, you'll hear evidence that will prove the time, the place, the DNA. And then at trial, they put on the DNA evidence. And then if you look at slide, give me 1 second to find it. If you look at slide 10, you'll see all the other evidence that the jury and the court heard outside of the DNA evidence. They heard testimony from Delia Rodriguez that the defendant, Mr. Morales, was at the bar the same night as Ms. Robillard. They heard testimony from Ramon Martinez that he identified weekly that Mr. Morales was the last person seen with Ms. Robillard, and they heard testimony from Ms. Investigator Silva that Mr. Morales had fresh cuts, but not serious cuts, on his hands, and that he had polished his boots with spray paint. So with that testimony, the state ended in its closing by saying, we have to prove that Ms. Robillard was murdered, and we think we've done that. Well, we also have to prove that Mr. Morales, the defendant right here, is the one who killed her, and how do we do that? He was the last person seen with her. How do we know that? DNA. The last witness that came in was DNA. And so when you take DNA out of the state's case through the presumption of Chapter 64, all the state is left with is that how do we know he was the last person seen with her? When you look at the testimony by Mr. Martinez, it probably was the last female at the bar. It appeared it might have been Ms. Robillard that Mr. Morales was talking to. So really, the state's closing without DNA evidence would have to look something like, how do we know that Mr. Morales is the murderer? Because it appeared, it might have been, it probably was Mr. Morales. If that's enough to secure a murder conviction in Texas, I guess God help us all, because this is a DNA case, always has been, and continues to be today. Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Morris.
Yes, Sean. The state doesn't concede that this was a DNA case. We understand that it was. We've never made light of that. We've argued that the inculpatory results...
Well, would you argue that the only evidence you have without DNA is the evidence of Mr. Martinez, which is a very weak identification at best?
So as to the inculpatory results, those five places where his DNA was found, we would agree that an exclusion would meet the Chapter 64.
No, that's not my question to you. My question is that if you take all the DNA out, that all you have is an eyewitness by Mr. Martinez that was just cited. If you take all the DNA, that's all that's left of the state's case.
By and large, Judge, he was still found by other witnesses in the bar. There was some evidence that would tend to...
Yeah, there was evidence that she was there.
Okay. Yes, Judge. We would agree that our case was not beyond a reasonable doubt in any way absent the DNA. Okay. Which is why we don't contest that as the items that inculpated him. If this court finds that they met the retestability under either prong, the state would concede that he would meet identity and preponderance of the evidence as to the items that inculpated him, because they definitively would support an identity, and they definitively, if they excluded the defendant, would be able to point to both the perpetrator and show him as innocent. What we have is that they did a fishing expedition. They basically wanted almost every piece of evidence that was collected in this case tested, regardless of whether or not it could do anything to move the needle in this case. They wanted the evidence in his vehicle retested, which, as we've stated before, has almost no ability to tell us who the perpetrator was or if exculpatory results occurred actually prove that Mr. Morales didn't commit this crime, because there's no tie with his vehicle to the murder scene absent him being the person who committed the crime. Third-party DNA would not actually do anything there, so it cannot exculpate him. So retesting that DNA is not going to move the needle. There will never support a finding that he didn't commit this crime just because there's third-party DNA in his vehicle. As to much of the DNA they want tested is just the really bloody clothes of the victim, her pullover, her bra. They haven't shown why any of that specifically would exculpate him or even show identity. The only pieces that they have would be those items that inculpated him, which have been subject to testing. And so the hurdle there would be the retesting. I don't believe that just by contesting his DNA, they should be able to wipe it out completely as to every other element and just say, well, I want everything tested. As a policy argument, Chapter 64 is a narrowly tailored gateway to get specific pieces retested because they have exceedingly probative value. And just saying the state's case was weak, we want everything retested, is not what you get here. I think you could get certain pieces of evidence retested, and the state's not going to argue that he would never be able to prove the second two prongs of Chapter 64 on any evidence. He definitely does as to the inculpatory evidence. It's just whether or not he's entitled to retesting of that evidence. As to the other evidence, we do say they failed to meet those prongs because they did not support identity being at issue or why that evidence itself would actually do anything in light of the inculpatory results. And just saying, well, I challenge the inculpatory results, so we just exclude them, well, that would open the door to every piece of evidence being tested so long as it's a DNA case. And that's not what Chapter 64 says. It's supposed to be a limited and focused chance to look at certain pieces of evidence, even in Rudier.
Let me ask you the question that I asked counsel for Mr. Morales, and that is, taking that blood stain and the other evidence that found that whatever the ratio was, for Hispanics, the largest one. Let's say you retest it using 23. We know that if you find someone else's DNA, it will shrink the likelihood, possibly. Well, we'll assume. What kind of numbers would it do to Mr. Morales if it's his, if the lab was good and we don't have to worry about the lab and it was his blood? What does it do to his?
So we don't have any numbers. The only testimony was by Dr. Nelson, and she actually says, I suppose if there was somebody who was related to him, biologically related to him, adding more locations might eliminate him. So if a close family member was the actual donor of that blood, he might be eliminated by adding new locations.
So only a close family member?
Possibly. There is a mixture problem, as the appellee stated, although none of that hypothetical or evidence was before the trial court. The trial court didn't hear anything about how those mixtures could work. Potentially a mixture could cause the fracturing as his hypothetical did, but we don't know. The likelier result would be what Dr. Nelson said, at least as far as what was heard in this case. As a lawyer, I don't know the science behind all of this, so I can't speak specifically to how this would have came out, but Dr. Nelson is the only expert who testified in this case, and she said, absent a family member, the likelihood of him being eliminated is very small. What they might find is another donor. And a second donor being found is not exculpatory here. It would just prove there was two people who were at that crime scene, not one. It may not even prove that, because if his blood drop fell on another place with DNA, that DNA might not inculpate anyone at all. It's just that his DNA was found at her vehicle, which is odd in its location as to why that ties him to the crime, potentially, if we keep the inculpatory results. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
My
thank
time.
You. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you. The case will be under submission. Thank you.